Mr. Balance, 306. We were talking about when you actually landed. How deep was it?
Well, we landed in about 3 foot of water. So, all our work would have been unnecessary. And we stopped at the head of the beach, we were told to remove, first of all, by hand, the explosive charges on the water.
So you didn't blow them?
Well, and we were told to remove them by hand and then to remove the waterproofing. But most of us accidentally fired them off. We did it much cleaner and easier. And then we were told just to fire little tin signs, arrows which had been stuck into the ground. And ours, I think, had 53 on it, which was our serial number. And so we just followed them and eventually caught up with the rest of the squadron in the field.
Now, this would be at Cully,
yes.
I believe.
Yes.
Where you were to stay from, roughly speaking, the 17th to the of June to the 26th of June, just before Epsom.
Yes,
so, you know, right. A couple of weeks almost. Yes. I want to look at what the sort of what the conditions of service were like there, because it's a good place to actually look at what it was happening. Where were you? How would you park up and organise your tanks and everything?
Well, A Squadron, we were in a sunken lane which was overgrown with trees and high hedges. So we were pretty well camouflaged naturally there.
Did you assist the camouflage?
Yes.
How?
We put our own camouflage nets up over the tanks.
Were they just a dyed net, or would they have bits of twigs stuck in the room?
No, just a net with little coloured strips of material in. Which were very good, really. But they were inflammable later. And we were issued various orders, such as nobody was allowed to cross a field diagonal. We had to walk round the hedgerows so that there would be no tracks showing from the air. And all vehicle marks, once we were in, had to be covered up so that they couldn't be seen in the track marks. And in daylight hours, we just kept under the camouflage.
What about your bivouacs? What was the bivouac arrangement for a tank crew?
Well, it was a bivouac which you tied onto the side of the tank, or the back if you wanted, or the front come to that. It was a small tent about, say, 10 feet by 8, and at its highest point, I suppose, it was about 4 feet high, or 5 feet high. You could just roll your 5 sleeping bags out in there and sleep. That's all, really. You'd sit in the daytime if it was raining, play cards or read books or whatever. Nothing very grand.
And where this would all be stored on the back of the tank?
Yes.
Had you bolted various containers onto the tank, boxes and things to store things, or was this built in by the manufacturers?
They were built in by the manufacturers. There were bins at the sides for tools of various sorts. And we also had, if I remember now, an emergency petrol tank fixed to the back of the tank, which is 2 50-gallon drums welded into one, and a bracket on the back, and just a rubber pipe that went into the petrol system somehow. And so you could run for, I focusing about 20 miles without touching your main tanks. And then you could jettison this one that was on the back. They were called jettison tanks.
And so would you actually dig in at all, or would you have any slit trenches near you in case you were attacked by air, or were you confident in the...
I don't recall that. Yeah, I did do any digging. But there is a talking of digging, there is a relevant thing which I haven't mentioned yet, which I possibly ought to now. When we were in the latter stages when we were Britain, it was decided that each regiment, I think, should have one tank equipped with a bulldozer blade. And oddly enough, mine was selected. And we had, just like a bulldozer, I think, fitted on the front of the tank. Worked with hydraulics by the driver inside. And when that was done, the tank became so difficult to manoeuvre that it was decided that it would no longer be in 4 Troop, but it would be transferred to Squadron Headquarter Troop. And so at this stage now, I was the 4th tank with the same crew and the same corporal commanding, the 4th tank in Squadron Headquarters Troop.
And would you still? You'd still had your guns.
Oh yes.
The only difference was the blade.
The blade, which obscured the driver's view pretty much. If he closed down, he couldn't see at all. So he had to rely on the commander to tell him what to do. So, which leads me to the digging. I remember we went along this sunken lane. A smooth patch where each tank would be, so that they had a level playing field to sleep on, which was quite good.
One thing that's mentioned in the thing is that this is where you first were introduced to compo rations, composition rations in
yes.
boxes.
Yes.
Could you explain the whole compo system and what you thought of the food?
Yeah. The combo system was a 15-man pack which would feed 15 men for one day. There were 7 varieties of these packs, that is for the main courses in them. I can't remember them all. One would be stewed steak, one would be McConaughey. I can't remember. One was corned beef, which was very popular. As I say, they would feed 15 men for one day. But so you would get, in a tank crew of 5, you would be given a pack which would last you for 3 days. And it would all tin. Separate from the pack, you would get a tin of biscuits, which would last you probably 14 days, so depending on the size of tin, very hard biscuits. And in the pack was, well, just about everything. To start off, let's say, with breakfast, and perhaps be some cans of beans, or of a cooked bacon, horrible stuff, and a tin of jam, a tin of margarine, and butter. The little packs of coffee or tea. There would even be loo paper, packet of it. And there would be boiled sweets and bars of chocolate to munch if you couldn't cook a meal. And for the main meal, which was always taken at midday if possible, there would be, as I say, a selection. And one pack you'd get corned beef, which is very popular because you do a lot of things with that. and of course we eat it uncooked. And cooked tinned vegetables and a tinned pudding of some sort, spotted dick or rice pudding. And then for the evening meal, or the second meal, that would be, say, tinned cheese. I can remember the email. And of course, you had these biscuits.
And how would you cook or heat up?
Well,
this would be the co-driver, I think you said.
Yes. He had a little petrol stove with a burner in it and a Dixie can, which was about 6 inches by 6 inches and about 4 inches deep. And he'd empty the cans into that and stew them up or put them in water in it and heat them. But later on, when you remove it, I think I mentioned before, we used to jam the cans in the exhaust. And they would be hot when you took them out and ready to eat. It was quite useful.
Now, who discovered that? I mean, or did you work it out for yourself?
I don't know. We all did it, but who did it first of all? I don't know. And another way of cooking, which when we first got there, we weren't allowed to do, but was to get an empty biscuit tin, half fill it with sand, put a bit of petrol in, put a match to it. And he just threw on the top, which was quite effective. And found a problem, I think.
So, what about now the cook? That was a composition, and it specifically says that's what they were on mostly at Cully. But what about the cooks? What would they do for
the
you?
Cooks.
The cooks themselves. Did they prepare meals ever for you? Or
Not at that stage. They were in the echelon, and they prepared the meals for the chaps in the echelon, driving over lorries and that sort of thing. And in the battalions, the infantry, they did take up hot meals to them, but we had these.
So you didn't see that you didn't get the cooks from at all?
No.
What about things like other parts of rations? I mean, where was your water supply coming from?
Each squadron had a 1500 weight water truck which would come up at dark in the evening, and you had, I think, 2 per tank, 4.5 gallon water cans which you filled, and they were strapped onto the tank. Later on in Normandy, they were always one was filled with cider, to my knowledge, which got very potent because it heated up on the back of the tank, and then it cooled, and then it was heated again and again, and it was quite potent stuff.
And what about, I mean, tea, was that very important? People always go on about army tea.
Oh, but yes.
Was it really important, brewing up? And
yes. When you were on the move, I mean, you'd start off with, if you were lucky, a mug of tea and biscuits and chocolate. Very, very important. And even during the day, in action, you would say to the co-driver, "Oh, make a brew, for goodness sake." And he would make it in his compartment and pass mugs up through. Oh yes, it really was important.
And how would he brew tea in the tank? Would he use the primus, the petrol stove?
Yes.
Or would he, not this box system, and throwing a match in?
No, do it inside.
Other things, a cigarette ration.
Yes.
Did that come up regularly?
Yes, I think each man got a tin of 50 a week. But we all seemed we had stacks of them in the tank. I don't know. Some didn't smoke or we stocked up and bought them in the UK and in the Neffy and so on. We always paid plenty of cigarettes.
Did you smoke much yourself?
Yes, all day.
How many a day were you on? I mean, it's difficult to...
The days were very long. Once we were in action, they were very long. And so you would smoke probably 40 a day, I don't know.
And what about rum ration? Did you ever get that? Or
yes, oh yes. The rum ration, they were in 1 gallon jars, stone jars, and the ration was a pint between 20 men. And so that one chap would go in with a mug, which would hold a pint from the troop, and he'd bring it back. And that would be divided in 4 mugs for the 14 crews. And we would just pass it around and have a sip each.
You wouldn't save it, or would you?
I don't think we don't save it.
Now, what about latrines at Cully, or generally? But we're using Cully to start with.
Yes.
What arrangements were made for latrines?
Well, each tank had a shovel. And in the ration packs, there was loo paper. And you simply took the shovel and found a spot.
They didn't have a dug latrine special place for you?
No, not there. Not. Later on, when we were resting, yes, we would have those sort of thunderboxes, we called them. But there, no, we just took that spade, I remember.
Was there much discipline about disposal of rubbish, all these tin cans and generally? I mean,
yes, there was. We buried them. We weren't allowed to just throw anything anywhere.
And it would be actually buried?
Yes.
And what about, did you ever, did you visit the village much, Cully Village, or any other?
No. What we were more interested in was the relics of the battle that had taken place before we got there. It was the old knocked out tank around.
British or German?
British. Well, Canadian, actual fact.
Was it the Sherman?
Yes.
What state was it in?
Brewed up. And there were one or two bodies around. But we weren't encouraged to stay away. A, for mines in the area, which deterred one from wandering around. And B, they were very concealment conscious.
How did you feel about this knocked-out Sherman? Sorry, you know, I mean, did it shake you a bit, seeing a brewed-up Sherman, or...?
Well, I suppose one adopted the attitude at that stage, it couldn't happen to me.
You still had no real idea about the Sherman's catching light?
No. The first time that I personally realised how easily the Shermans caught fire was our first day in action, when I heard over the air, so-and-so's brewing up.
I'll come on to that, because that's going to be quite soon, actually.
Yes.
Was there any sign, any in this area, while you were there, any German shell fire or air activity or...
Well, we could hear it, but there was nothing close by. We could hear guns, artillery, and so on, and planes.
I think the next thing then is what I stopped you on almost is Operation Epsom, which was on the 26th of June 1944, when you were advancing on Sher. Now, could you run through the events of that day, as I know it's a long time ago, in as much detail as you remember, and starting possibly with what level of briefing you got?
Well, I think the day before we were briefed, and we were shown the map where we were expected where the front line was, where the Germans were, where we were to form up, and what time we were to start, the order of march, where we were to go. I don't remember it in detail. But I do remember we formed up in the dark, and we weren't the leading squadron. I can't remember who was. And we started off. And as I say, before very long, I heard over there so-and-so's brewing up, so-and-so's brewing up. And I think I said to somebody in the crew, what on earth are they brewing up for at this time? Thinking they were brewing tea. And, but they weren't, of course. We then saw them when the pillars of smoke and flame and so on.
What did it look like, a tank brewing up, from your perspective?
A fearsome thing. Fearsome. It had a great column of flame and turning into black smoke. And you realize possibly the crew were in there.
Could they usually get out?
Yes, yes. Once they realised, but those unfortunate ones happened to, in the first instance, a lot didn't get out quick enough. But one quickly catches on in those situations.
So you had to move instantaneously to get out,
yes.
And if you didn't, you might get caught.
Right.
The driver couldn't always get out with the turret.
If the gun was over his hatch, he couldn't open it, except for a few inches. But behind him was an escape hatch in the floor, which was very difficult to get out of, because the clearance wasn't very great. And in theory, the whole crew could have got out of that, but it's so difficult. I never attempted it, to my knowledge, off from the turret.
So the turret people would go through, you'd go through the wireless operator,
yes.
And the other two would go through the commander's one.
Yes, yes.
So you were moving forward, mm-hmm. with the headquarters troop,
yes.
And with your blade, presumably.
Yes.
Would the blade would be carried up or down?
Well, it had to be up. Give clearance, you know, otherwise you'd be bulldozing all the time.
Of course. It wouldn't go right up, though.
I know. So it would be, say, about 2 feet off the ground, the bottom of it, and the blade itself would be, I suppose, 3 or 4 feet. So it really just blocked out the driver's vision completely, almost.
And what happened next, then?
Well, my memory is extremely vague of that. They were held up in front, and so we were not the Indian squadron. We were just lined up along the track, following on, waiting to go through or to branch out, because we had to cross the ford over the Odin. And there were a lot of snipers about in that area, and I felt very sorry for the red cap. He was stood at the field, supposedly directing traffic, but he had been sniped at, and that didn't need anybody there to direct it anyway, because it wasn't moving. And there were snipers in the wood, and I remember for some reason, I think we were told go off and clear the snipers from a part of this wood. And I imagine because we couldn't get the tank into the wood, I remember being on foot with Stengun and other members of the crew, the brain, and firing up into these trees, and in turn being fired at. And I remember crawling very rapidly along the ground, and a chap crawling beside me, giving vent to the most awful language, until we got to the edge of the wood or a clearing or something and stood up, and he turned out to be the padre. That's my most vivid memory of the first part of the thing. Eventually we did go over the island.
Would that be the first day or anything else that day?
It all seems to merge into one at this stage.
I know that's now after the first bit they did pull back into lager. Now this is the first lager really you've been.
Yes.
What could you explain what a lager was and how it how you organised yourselves?
Well, it was a lager, but just grouping together for the nut. Really, just for safety and for somewhere where you could replenish.
So how would you lay your tanks out?
Well, orders would be given over the air, the lager location. It would be an open space field, and we'd say something like A squadron left, B squadron right, C second left, RHQ in the middle or something. And you would drive in at second in command would have gone back, and he would guide you. And you just park nose to tail.
Right on each other, or with a big gap?
You would leave a gap between the lines, big enough for the lorries to come along, the petrol, and ammunition.
And how much gap between each tank in the line?
Very little. Very little.
So, really, nose to tail?
Nose to tail, yes.
And then. So that was that. And then, what about the replenishment? What was your job in line? Because you couldn't just go to bed, so to speak.
No. Well, the first thing we did was get something to eat. Because the replenishment in lorries wouldn't go up until it was well and truly dark. And so you've got to wait for that. So you have something to eat. Clean the guns. And sort out the ammunition if you fired a lot. You want to have to throw out the empties if they were still in. And, of course, count how many you needed of each type. And the driver would check his petrol to see how much of that he needed. And whichever the lorry, if the petrol lorry came first, he would say, you know, how much they want, you say, 10 cans, 20 cans, whatever. You get it off the lorry and hand it up one to the driver to fill up the tank, and he put a funnel in the filler and pull it in. And you stack the empty cans down beside the tank, and the lorry would come around again and pick them up and take them away. And so the water truck would come, you'd fill your water cans, and the ammunition lorries would come.
That would be your thing, would it, the ammunition
lorry?
Yes, ball?
I'd say, we want so many AP, so many AT, and whatever, so many Bs, and a Browning lorry. And we would get them, then we'd uncase them, they were all cases.
What were they?
Well, each round was in an individual pressed cardboard case, rather like a bottle of malt whiskey is today. Then you would take that off. And in some cases, they would come up in a wooden container with perhaps four of them, and you'd have to open them up and bomb up. And once you've done all that, you might put the bivvy up, but it probably wouldn't be worth it. You'd sleep in the tank, just on the ground.